You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
I got this when I went to Walt Disney World. Oh, 1985. It was I went with my grandparents. They lived in Florida. I spent my summers with them. And get this, as a Florida resident back then, they could get an annual pass to Walt Disney World for $35. Because they wanted them to bring people to spend lots and lots more money. But anyway, I got this at Walt Disney World, and I love it. It was, like, so cool. It was my goofy hat. And how many of you have ever been to Disney World or Disneyland or even just a theme park, like Hershey Park or something like that? And I'll say theme park because I don't want to put Del Grosso's or Lakemont or Knoebels. Like, that's not quite the same thing. But a theme park that has things that are on purpose. And at Walt Disney World, there was some very interesting things that happened because of the guy named Walt Disney. And Walt Disney was an incredible creative guy. He did some incredible things with creativity, with leadership and things like that. And this is Walt Disney right there, if you haven't seen him. And here he's talking about Disney. I don't know if that's Disney World or Disneyland. I think that might be Disney World. He died before Disney World was finished. But he was alive when Disneyland happened. But there were some things about Walt Disney that are pretty interesting because he was a detail guy. Walt Disney was interested in the details, and where most of us would be like, well, does that even matter? Even that, like, why does that matter? And some of the things he did, because he wanted people to come into Walt Disney World and experience the magic of Disney. And it's kind of true. If you've been there, it's aside from the lines and the heat, there's definitely a different feeling there than even like a great park like Hershey Park or something like that, because it was designed with he wanted people to feel the magic. And so there were some detailed things that he did. So like one of the things, and you're probably aware of this, but characters were not allowed to be seen out of costume. So like you will never at Walt Disney World see a character with, you know, not Dumbo. Dumbo doesn't have pants. Like goofy pants, but not wearing the goofy top with a guy like in the corner smoking a cigarette. Like, you'll never see that at Walt Disney World. That would be immediate firing if you were found out of costume outside of the dressing room. Even some specific things is that the people who work as characters, if they're Mickey Mouse or Cinderella or whatever, they are bound by contract not to tell anyone what part they play, what character they play. Because Disney didn't want everyday people to ruin the magic of that. That seems like a little detail. Does that really matter? Well, it kind of does, because for little kids, they're like, wait a second. You were just smoking a cigarette over there, and now you're Cinderella. I didn't think she did that. It just changes the vibe there. So that was one of the detail things. Like, even that, yeah, even that mattered. Other things, the lands, get this, in the Magic Kingdom in Walt Disney World, they are separated and spaced at angles so that when you are in one of the lands, meaning Frontierland, Adventureland, Fantasyland, whatever, Tomorrowland, that you cannot see. If you're in one of the lands, you cannot see into another land. Because he didn't want that to throw off the vibe. You don't want to be in Tomorrowland and looking over and seeing like a, you know, they saw the Mike Fink keelboats. That's really old. But to see like, you know, a canoe and the treehouse or whatever. Like, he made it so that, because if you're in this world, in this land, if you saw another one, it would mess things up. It's not a big deal. To him, it was. Because those details mattered. It was even that. Even something like that mattered to him. Other interesting things, you probably have heard about this, but there is a system of tunnels called Utilidors, underneath Magic Kingdom. And the reason that they're there, there's actually multiple reasons they're there, but number one is, my ear. Number one of the reasons was that, you know, in normal parks, like at Hershey Park, you can watch them open the door and you'll see the Hershey Bar guy, you know, character kind of make their way through till they get over to where they're going to be. Well, you would never spot a Fantasyland character in Adventureland because, again, that would throw off the vibe. And so there's these corridors, these hallways, massive hallways underneath the layer of Walt Disney World, Magic Kingdom, so that characters can get to their land without throwing off the feeling, without throwing off the vibe there. And like, even that, does that matter? Well, it does, because if you're looking for a magic of Frontierland and there's people that are in Frontierland that are from the future, it doesn't work. And so that was a little detail that mattered. Other interesting things about these tunnels. He didn't want to see in his parks, he didn't want people to be pushing trash dumpsters around. And so every trash can, which are 30 feet apart, because he didn't want anyone to have an excuse not to throw something away, and they're disguised in little common, like they don't look like, here's a trash can. But they're 30 feet apart, and every trash can actually has a pneumatic sucking system that sucks it all under the park to another place where they would compact it and get rid of it. Because he didn't want to have someone pushing a dumpster or one of those carts, or even, you know, because he didn't, that would throw off the magic. You don't want to have trash around. Interesting thing else, Main Street USA and throughout the parks, they use a system that's a patented system called a smellitizer. And they actually will spray, pump, in like Main Street USA, they pump the scent of vanilla and fresh popcorn into the air. Because you go in there and you're like, oh, wow, it feels like that. And in Pirates of the Caribbean, they actually pump in the smell of smoke. And so they're throughout the park because he wants you to not only experience it, but to smell it. And, like, does the smell matter? Well, if you've been in Orlando in a packed crowd when the temperature is 95 degrees, the smell matters. So it does. But so even something like that, like he's like, I want this to be an experience. And so you've got the smell that affects what's happening in the park. What else? That's just a bunch of the little things that Disney did on purpose, because he was so interested in the little details. He was so interested that the little things mattered. And most people would be like, well, that's not a big deal. He's like, no, it is to me. Because the little things matter, and even though he was the great Walt Disney, like he was the boss, he's like, no, I care about these little things. And in a similar way, that's how God feels about us. Is that there's things in our life where we're like, oh, that doesn't really matter. God's God. He's the God of the universe. No sky can contain all that he is. He wouldn't care about me. He wouldn't care about this particular situation in my life. He doesn't care about that little detail, and I would say he absolutely does. He absolutely does, and he has the power to handle every detail in your life. So, because we're often like, well, this isn't a big deal. Like, I'm not going to bother God with that. God can't help with this. Like, he doesn't care about what I'm going to wear or that thing that's happening tomorrow. Like, but he does. He does care about even the little details, even those things. And this will make sense in a moment, since the series is called Senses. This will make sense. Okay, we're making sense because we're talking about our sense, of smelling, which, we had our scent blocked here. By the way, I love Starburst. I said to Steph, if she did that with Skittles, like, I would not have been able to figure it out, but I'm on my Starburst game. So I didn't know what she was doing, by the way. She's doing it all without any of the elders knowing what's going on. So what we're talking about in this Senses series, we're on the second week, and we're looking at four of the five. And again, the very last week, as we mentioned last week, our fifth Sunday week, there's going to be a special interactive event for prime groups, for all the prime groups to sign up and be a part of. You'll get more details about that. But the point this week is that our sense of smell, that's all the way to the biggest strap, our sense of smell can underestimate the extent of God's power. So, like, this is weird. Okay, how are you going to talk about smell in the Bible? Well, there's a really cool passage, and believe it or not, on purpose, Kendra, when whoever, or maybe it was Jack, I don't know who chose the songs for today, Jack, they were all picked specifically about this topic. But we're going to look at this passage that's in Daniel chapter 3. We'll turn on the house lights here. If you have a paper Bible, you can turn to Daniel 3 in YouVersion. It's about halfway through the list is Daniel. And then 3 is, again, after 2 and before 4. And we're looking at this passage. And actually, I taught about this passage a long time ago in a series called Strong on the life of Daniel. But we're looking at a power play because God's power, our sense of smell, can underestimate the extent of God's power. Because what I mean by extent means that God's power even applies to the little details. He even has power over the little things. And we're going to be looking at this what I'm calling a power play, because as we look at this passage, power is like all, this is all about power. and who thinks they have power, who pretends they have power, who wants to have power, and who really does have power. And just before we get into the passage here, I want to give you a little bit of a background. Daniel takes place after the exile. So what that means, or during the exile, I should say, what that means is, as we talked about even last week, we were looking at Kings. Throughout the book of Kings, the 1st and 2nd Kings and the 1st and 2nd Chronicles, God was sending prophets to the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. They were split into two. And we'll ignore northern right now. But the southern kingdom of Israel, they were told, get right with God or he's going to bring in some judgment. Get right with God or he's going to do something. And we talked about Habakkuk last week and how it was, you need to obey God or someone's going to come in and exile you. Well, Daniel is, that happened. That has happened. The southern kingdom was exiled into captivity by Babylon. And we used, in the story series, we said that Babylon brings. They grab, they would, that's how they would conquer a nation. They would grab the people and take them back to their home city so that they could control them there. And so all of the nation of Judah, the remaining people, the Israelites at that point, were all taken, for the most part, back to the land of Babylon. And Daniel takes place, the book of Daniel takes place in Babylon. And so in Babylon, the people are there for 70 years, and eventually they go back, and we talked about this. No, we didn't talk about this. I recorded the video for next week because I'll be on vacation. So we talked about this next week. That's really weird, but that's true. So next week, you're going to hear about Nehemiah and the people coming back to the land after 70 years. That's weird and trippy there. but anyway, so that's where we are. So we're in Daniel. We're in Babylon. The king of Babylon is a guy named Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel, the book, the guy that wrote the book, and then three guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were put in charge of the, they got high positions in the Babylonian kingdom. So some of these Jewish people that came into the land were given roles, they were given titles based on their aptitude, and like, you know, you got a lot of people coming in, you need to help manage the people. So Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego all worked for the king in kind of higher roles. You know, they were like upper level management kind of stuff. So that's kind of where we are. They're serving in Babylon, these three guys, because the nation has been exiled there. And that's where we start. Okay, you with me? Good. Okay, so there's a number of things that are happening with power. First of all, we have an image of power. An image of power in the first part of this verse, of this passage in Daniel 3. And it says this, King Nebuchadnezzar, he's the king of Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar made a gold statue 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. That is freaking big. Okay, 90 feet tall. This roof is 22 feet. Okay, 90 feet is give or take a 9-story building. Anybody know how tall is Kish Apartments? How many floors? 7? Okay, so not even as tall as Kish Apartments, but I think it's probably the tallest building in Lewistown. Is there anything taller that has stories? I don't think any more floors than that. How many is the hospital? That's 6. 7? 7 at the hospital. 7, yeah. So this is like a 9-story building. And so he made this thing. But here's an interesting thing. This is the NLT, and it says gold statue. If you're looking at the NIV or other translations, it'll say gold image. And that word matters. The word image, in case you care what it's actually written in Aramaic. The word is chelem. So there you go, chelem. Salem, or Salem, it's Salem. But the word means an image. And an image is not just a statue. An image was set up as something that represents something else. And so this is an image that Nebuchadnezzar made. And so as we read it, we're like, yeah, that is one honking huge statue. No. Nebuchadnezzar is making an image of himself. This was to represent his greatness, his power. And that's why, as we go on through the story, it kind of makes sense why he gets a little ticked off. But it was meant as an image. And of course, if you read in Genesis, humanity has been created as in the image of God. It's the same word that we are representing God to this world, to this earth. Unlike anything else God created, humanity is unique. And that we have a way of representing God. And we're not going to talk about that anymore. But this is what that word means. This wasn't just a statue. It was an image, and it was very tall. And so he set it up on the in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Again, we're in Babylon. Then he sent messages to the high officers, officials, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the provincial officials to come to the dedication of the statue he had set up. So basically, everybody in authority. So all these officials came and stood before the statue King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald shouted out, "People of all races and nations and language, listen to the king's command. When you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and other musical instruments." So basically, everybody, when you hear anything, what you need to do is bow to the ground to worship King Nebuchadnezzar's gold statue, to worship King Nebuchadnezzar's image. You need to bow down and worship that image representing King Nebuchadnezzar, and you need to recognize that Nebuchadnezzar is the king. He is in charge. He is great. He's 9 feet wide, great. He's 90 feet tall, great. And so when you see that, whenever you hear any kind of instrument, you need to bow down and worship not just this gold statue. This isn't an idol in the sense of we're worshiping a god. You are bowing down to worship Nebuchadnezzar because he is the king and he is in charge and he is almighty and all powerful. And he says, anyone who refuses to obey will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. So stakes are high. Okay, you know, like that's, you know, there isn't a fine here. We just jump right to the furnace. So at the sound of the musical instruments, all the people, whatever their race or nation or language, bowed to the ground and worshiped the gold statue that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So there was this statue that he set up to represent as an image of his power. Because Nebuchadnezzar wanted everybody to know that he is the greatest. And you're going to worship. You're going to be like, "Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, you are so great. We are totally going to bow to you. And if you don't, I'm going to kill you." So either way, he wins. You're either bowing because you want to or bowing because you don't, but you're bowing. And so that was his first part of this power play, was an image of power from Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the story twists a little bit, because now we've got what I'm calling a grasp for power. We got a bunch of sniveling tattletales. Because these people, as we introduce, meet them in the story, they're just trying to grasp for power. They're like, "Ooh, I'm going to impress the king, and then maybe he'll like me more. I'm gonna do that, and then maybe I'll be really, you know, important." Just like that the kid that was friends with Scott Farkas, the little kid there with the, you know, and he was a little toady. What was his name? Did he have a name? Anybody know? A Christmas Story? A little kid? He was like, "Yeah." You know, anyway. Okay. Anyway. Like, what was that? Grover. Grover Dill. All right. I didn't know. There you go. There we know. So these guys are kind of playing that game. Like, I'm gonna suck up to the king so it'll look really good. And so the passage continues in verses 8 through 12 and says, "But some of the astrologers went to the king," and this is just kind of the high leaders too, but by saying that they were astrologers, it meant these weren't Jewish people. These weren't Jewish officials. These were Babylonian pagan officials. And so they went to the king and informed on the Jews. They ratted them out. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "Long live the king!" You know, "You're great. You issued a decree requiring all the people to bow down and worship the gold statue," you know, that gold image of you, how great you are, "when they hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and other musical instruments." Like, something about that list is important because, I don't know. "That decree also states that those who refuse to obey must be thrown into a blazing furnace." Like, Nebuchadnezzar, just repeating back what you said. "I've been paying attention. I got all the instruments. I know the rules. But there are some Jews," those Jews, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom you have put in charge of the province of Babylon." These are important officials. "And they pay no attention to you, your majesty. They refuse to serve your gods," and here's that distinction, "and do not worship the gold statue you have set up." And see, these guys recognize, as we were just saying, that this statue wasn't a god. That's separate. There's a bunch of gods that they would worship, lowercase g, but also not even worshiping this image, this representation of the great Nebuchadnezzar. So they're trying to go to the king and be like, hey, maybe he'll like us now because we're ratting these guys out. So there's a grasp for power there. And that's just kind of playing the story along here. So there we go. And then it leads us to a declaration of power. And here, Nebuchadnezzar is just telling everyone how great he is. Or specifically, he's telling Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego how great he is. And so, continuing on in verse 13, it says, then Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage. And let me see if I have my notes here. Yeah. Did I write that down? Oh. I didn't write it down. Oh, yeah, that's later. Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, we'll come back to that. Okay, so I did write it down, but it has nothing to do with it right now. So then Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage and ordered that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought before him. When they were brought in, Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you refuse to serve my gods or to worship the gold statue I have set up? Now, right here, I mean, this is legit. A good leader, the power of a leader to not do something also demonstrates power. Like, there's power in that. And so he says, I'll give you one more chance. Just to kind of declare his power. Like, I am that amazing that I'm going to give you one more chance to bow down and worship the statue I've made. When you hear, hey, thanks for shortening it for us. When you hear the sound of the musical instruments. But if you refuse, you will be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. And then what God, because he knows that they worship the God of Israel, the true and living God. And he says, what God, he uses a lowercase g, will be able to rescue you from what? My power. Again, other translations say my hand, but the word represents power. The hand means power. So he's saying, like, let me just tell you how I am so great, I'm so magnanimous, I'm going to give you a second chance. But just so you know, I have the power. Eventually that joke's not going to work because it's so old. Maybe it'll be a classic. It is a classic already, isn't it? Okay. Anyway, I got the power. Okay. Anyway, thank you. I can't quite do that. It's because of all those starbursts. They're still back in there. So continuing on, it says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied. So this was Nebuchadnezzar demonstrating his power, declaring his power. And they replied, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able. The root word able, the God we serve has the power to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. And they were respectful, your majesty. And I underlined this here because this is what we talked about in the Strong series, you know, almost a decade ago. I'm not going to talk about it now. I'll just mention, most of us know the story of this, the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the fiery furnace, the whole deal. And we're like, yeah, God rescued them. But what we forget is how they responded to Nebuchadnezzar. It wasn't, we're going to do this because we know God's going to rescue us. They said, we know he can. But they said, but even if he doesn't, even if we die, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, respect, that we will never serve your gods or worship the gold statue you've set up. And so again, I'm not going to get into that anymore, but just a pause to recognize these guys weren't just doing it because they were going to be saved. We see that after the fact. They were like, hey, we might die, but we're still not going to worship your gods because our God is bigger, because our obedience matters. So again, you can find that in the Strong series. So that was his declaration of power. He tells them that he has their fate in his hands, in his power, in his control. And then that leads to a demonstration of power. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is okay, these guys are a little bit obnoxious. They're not afraid of me. They're not afraid of my edict. They're not willing to bow down to that amazing statue that I made, my image, because I am amazing. And now he's a little bit, okay, I'm a little bit ticked off. And so at the beginning of verse 19, it says, Nebuchadnezzar was so furious, and this is what I was going to get to, with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that his face became distorted with rage. And this is the same word. It says that he was so angry that they didn't worship his image, that his image became distorted. And so, again, if you were reading it in Aramaic, you would be like, oh, that's the same word. But that's what's going on here. He was so angry they didn't worship his image that his own image didn't look as good as the actual image of gold. And he became distorted with rage. And so here he is. Wants to demonstrate his power. So he's angry. He's furious with these guys for not obeying, for not bowing down, because he's in control. So just to be clear about how great he is, he did some things, and I've highlighted them in those lovely pastel colors. They're pastel-ish. He commanded that, number one, look at the different things that are happening here. The furnace be heated 7 times hotter than usual. 7 times. That's a lot. Like, and I'm not going to get into all this now, but 7 is an ultimate number in the Bible. So it's kind of like he cranked it all the way up to the max. There was no higher it could go. So that's the first thing he did, 7 times hotter. And the second thing he did, then he ordered some of the strongest men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the furnace. So he got the strongest guys. He's like, I just want you to know, you're not getting out of this. I'm going to get the strongest guys to tie you up, so it's not going to be like, hey, I'm out of here. You know, like there was nothing there. It was clearly Nebuchadnezzar demonstrating how great his power was. The strongest guys are tying him up. And then it says, so they tied him up and threw them into the furnace. And I think this is interesting too. He says, fully dressed in their pants, turbans, robes, and other garments. Because if you want someone to burn up pretty good, you don't want to take off their clothing or throw them in just their undergarments, which is probably the standard, like the humiliation. He's like, no, I'm leaving them fully dressed so it'll all go up in one magic moment, in one powerful moment. So everything, they are fully, fully clothed. And of course, you got to remember, too, like they're not wearing, you know, neoprene or Kevlar or Mylar, anything that's fireproof. Like we're talking fibers that are going to catch fire if it's sunny out. Like that's the kind of stuff that we're looking at. And because the king, in his anger, and had demanded such a hot fire in the furnace, the flames killed the soldiers as they threw the 3 men in. So they're getting close to the fire, and the flames killed them. So there goes your strongest guys. Man, Nebuchadnezzar. But so just 4 things there. 7 times hotter, strongest people to bind it, fully dressed, and it was so hot, just in case there was any, like, I don't know, it didn't look like it was that big of a deal. The guys just that got near the fire died from the flames. And it says, so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, securely tied, fell into the roaring flames. So Nebuchadnezzar was just demonstrating, oh, my image is great because I am great, because I have the power. And I just want you to know how powerful I am, that you guys aren't just going to die. You're going to die. You're going to get real and dead. So that was his demonstration of power, which then led, and I want you to notice that this is on purpose, which then led to the extent of power, capital P-O-W-E-R, because now we're looking at the real power. And so the passage goes on and says, but suddenly Nebuchadnezzar jumped up in amazement and exclaimed to his advisors, didn't we tie up 3 men and throw them into the furnace? Yes, your majesty, we certainly did, they reply. Look, Nebuchadnezzar shouted, I see 4 men unbound, walking around in the fire, unharmed. And the 4th looks like a god. And the phrase Nebuchadnezzar uses here is God with lowercase g, or son of man. And there's multiple thoughts about what that is. Most, you know, evangelical Christian scholars believe that that was Jesus pre-incarnate, meaning before he came as a human at Bethlehem, you know, Christmas, remember that thing? That this was him with them in the fire. It might have just been an angel, a messenger of God, or whatever, but clearly they weren't alone, and whoever was there with them was not normal. And so the passage continues and says, then Nebuchadnezzar came as close as he could to the door of the flaming furnace, because, you know, those strong soldiers, their bodies are still there, kind of sizzling. And so he got as close as he could and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And this is what he says, servants of the capital most, capital H, high, capital G, God, servants of the most high God. Something is changing in him now. He's like, whoa, something is different here. Come out. Come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stepped out of the fire. Then the high officers, officials, governors, and advisors crowded around them. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had four things that he did to show his power. So God's like, oh, let me show you mine. So they crowded around him. The fire hadn't touched them. Not a hair on their heads was singed. And that's an important statement. How many of you have ever been near a fire pit, a fireplace, a burn barrel? Because the first thing to go is the hair. And that's what happened to me a long time ago. No. And then there's that wonderful smell of burnt hair. Like, it is nasty. Like, my knuckles, I'm not doing pretty well right now. But like, my burn barrel, like, oh, that'll be it. Oh, it's gone. It doesn't even need to burn you. It doesn't even hurt, but the hair goes. But not a hair on their heads was singed. And their clothing was not scorched. Remember, they were thrown in with all their clothes. They were unbound, so they got out of the ties somehow, but it was the strongest soldiers. And their clothing was not scorched, and they were in here with everything. It was the whole deal. And not even scorched. And then this last part, they didn't even smell of smoke. A sense of smell. Now it ties together. They didn't even smell of smoke. And I want you to recognize just for a moment what this means about God's power. What this means about the extent of God's power. Because Kendra is teaching Ignition, and she's going to be going through like an activity where they get to smell things. And Kendra and I were trying to discuss, like, what are some things that smell? Like, as soon as you go to a campfire, you come home and you smell it. Like, you don't smell it while you're there, but you come home and it's there. If you've gone to the farm show, right? If you've gone to the farm show, like, you get the farm show in you and you can't get it out. Like, it actually was the rule for our family. Each kid, one by one, would go to the basement and take off everything on the outside and leave it at the laundry room and come in the door. And that's what we do, because it would just stink. It would be in you. You couldn't get rid of it. And the idea of the smell of smoke, I mean, it sticks with you. They're in the furnace. Like, even if they didn't get burned. And again, if you've been around a campfire, you don't need to get burned. You smell like smoke. But they didn't even smell like smoke, because God was showing the extent of his power. God was saying, even that little detail matters to me. Even that little thing matters. Why? Because I just want you to see how great I am. I want you to realize how great I am. And just like Walt Disney was like, no, those details matter. God's like, even this detail matters. And I think, and you're going to see this pattern again and again as we continue this morning. But again, God undid everything Nebuchadnezzar did. But just to be clear here, right? Would any of you have doubted the miracle, or any of those people with Nebuchadnezzar, if the guys came out of the fire and smelled like smoke? No, I mean, if they came out of the fire and there were little burn marks there, but they're still alive. The soldiers are dead. No one would doubt the miracle then. But God's like, I'm going to go that far and just show you and show Nebuchadnezzar, which is going to matter in a second, the extent of my power. That they were in this blazing furnace and didn't even smell like smoke. That's how great God is. That's how powerful he is. And that's a little detail that it's like, that God, you didn't need to do that. And he's probably going, I know, but that's how great I am. Because every little detail matters to God. And every little instance in our lives matters to God. So that was the extent of God's power, which then led to a really cool thing, was an honor for power. Capital P-O-W-E-R. Because Nebuchadnezzar... It says, then Nebuchadnezzar said, praise to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel to rescue his servants. And the word angel there is messenger, someone. Doesn't mean it was an angel with wings, because angels didn't have wings like that anyway. But something to rescue him from his perspective, to rescue his servants who trusted in him. They defied the king's command and were willing to die rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make this decree. And I don't have time, but this word decree is an Aramaic word that means to taste and to give an opinion. It's kind of like, you know, what you would see on a judge on any kind of cooking show. They'd be, a little pitchy. No, wait, that's the other show with judges. But they'd taste it and be like, oh, yeah, this is good, or I like it, or five stars, or whatever. And he's like, I'm making a decree, because I have tasted this God And I'm saying to everyone, if any people, whatever their race or nation or language, speak a word against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, capital G, God of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, they will be torn limb from limb and their houses will be turned into heaps of rubble because the furnace thing just didn't work. So we need to try something else. We're moving on now. But they're going to be torn limb from limb, house be turned into rubble. Why? Because there is no other God who can rescue like this. So Nebuchadnezzar, God used this moment to change his heart. And you're going to read, you see more about that in Daniel. Like, God and Nebuchadnezzar, he's the Babylonian pagan king. But God is constantly working on this pagan king, which is a great topic for another day. It says, then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to even higher positions in the province of Babylon. So they were at the top, and now they're even higher. Why? Because of their God. And so you have this whole power play there about power. The image of power. Next slide. Showing how great Nebuchadnezzar was. The sniveling losers trying to battle for power, grasp for power. Nebuchadnezzar declares, no, look how great I am. Because I've got your life, your future, and your fate in my hands. And then he demonstrates it with the different things. And of course, God shows up and says, let me just show you how great my power is, the extent of my power. Because our sense of smell can underestimate the extent of God's power. And what we're talking about, this entire series is about senses and experiencing life. And last week we talked about sight and how our sight can misguide us. Next week we're talking about touch, right? Is that what I think it's next week. Is that what I taught on? Next week is about touch. And then the last week we're looking at hearing. And the idea is that we can't just rely on our senses and our experience and how we perceive life, because it misses, as we said last week, we live by faith. Not by sight. We live by faith, not by smell. We live by faith, not by hearing. We live by faith, not by touch. We live by faith, not by taste. We live by faith, not by experience. Because if we experience something good, then, oh, that must be good. If we experience something bad, it must be bad. But our sense of smell can underestimate the extent of God's power. And I want to talk about, in the few minutes I have left, this idea of even that. Even that, just as Walt Disney was concerned about, the smell in the air matters to me. Whether people see trash dumpsters matters to me. Whether people can look into another land and see the different people over there matters to me. And God matter, you matter to God. And even that, even those things were like, no, that's not really the case. And we talked about God's power, and this is on the slideshow loop with along with the Strong series. One week we talked about God's power in the Ruin series about Job, because everybody was questioning God's power, and then God shows up and shows his power. And then we also talked about it way back in the day during our I God series, and we looked at what is omnipotence or God all powerful mean. So you can find those on the slideshow loop. But God's power can handle a lot of things, even these little things. And the first thing is that God's power can handle every detail of your future. Every detail. Not most, not just the big picture things. God cares about every little detail. And God has power over every little detail of your future. And, you know, tomorrow looks pretty crazy. Next week looks pretty scary. Who knows what's going to happen next year? Like, we don't know any of those things. It's unknown. But he has every detail of your future handled. And I just want to, we're looking at some passages here of this kind of, even that. Like, why? God didn't need to do that. God didn't need to make it so they didn't smell like smoke. And this passage in Exodus chapter 14, you are all familiar with it, all of you watching online. If you've never been to church ever, you know this story. Unless you were born like, you know, last week. It says in Exodus chapter 14, of course, the story is they have left the land of Egypt. We talked all about this during the Stuck series. They left the land of Egypt and they are fleeing for their lives at that time. Pharaoh realizes that he let them go. He starts pursuing the Israelites out of Egypt, chasing them. And they come up to this body of water. It is a sea that is red. Actually, the word red is reeds, but we won't talk about that right now. But they come up to this body of water, and they're going, and they come, shocker, I know, they complain to Moses, and they say, why did you bring us out here to kill us? We could have just died back there. And so they're complaining, and then it says, the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the people to get moving. And they're like, body of water. There's a large body of water here. We do not have boats. There are millions of us. Tell the people to get moving. Pick up your staff, Moses, and raise your hand over the sea. Divide the water so the Israelites can walk through the middle of the sea on dry ground. And then it shares a thing in the middle there. And then it goes, then Moses raised his hand over the sea, and the Lord opened up a path through the water with a strong east wind. It says the wind blew all that night. So this wasn't like, boom. This was a long time as God parted the water. The wind blew all that night, turning the seabed into dry land. So the people of Israel walked through the middle of the sea on dry ground with walls of water on each side. Their steps were on dry ground. Nobody would have been like, oh, this is muddy. Oh, yeah, look at those fish floating right next to me in that wall of water. But boy, this is muddy. This miracle didn't quite work. No one would have questioned the extent of the miracle. No one would have been like, this didn't work. But God went even to that. He's like, no, we're not just going to make you walk through on swampy, muddy ground. It's going to be dry. And what used to be a sea, it used to be a large body of water. Because God cares about even that. And just that detail of what's the next step, literally for the Israelites, the next step is onto the dry ground in the middle of the Red Sea. And that detail, God cared about that. And that was their next step. And I want you to know that God cares about your next step as well. He has power over it. And you might go, oh man, I just don't know how I'm going to get through this. I don't know how I'm going to overcome. I don't know how to make the right decision. And we'll talk more about that next week. I don't know what's going to happen next. And God is saying, I can even put your feet on dry ground. Because I have power over everything. Over every step. Over every detail of your future. And that's not just the big details. That's also the small details. God is big. And he's incredible. But it's so easy sometimes to forget and think, why would we matter to God? And that is a legit thing. Why would the God of the universe care about us? David even said that. Who is man that you're mindful of me? Who am I that you would care about me? But that's how great God is. And yet, he loves us and cares about us intimately and deeply. And so the next step, whatever that looks like, God's got it. God has power over it. God has the control over it. And maybe you're going to walk through on a muddy spot. And maybe that's what he's got for you. But he even has the power to put your feet on dry ground. And don't take this metaphor too far that everything you do is going to be perfect. Because God brings hurt and pain on purpose into our lives. And that's legit. That's good. But I just don't want you to miss that. Every detail of your future, he's got it. There's nothing that he doesn't care about. There's nothing that doesn't matter. Just like the people building Walt Disney World. Not Mickey Mouse, what's his name? Walt Disney was like, no, every detail matters. And God's power can handle every detail of your future because God is in the details. The second thing is that God's power can handle every need you have. And we talked about this a little bit last week. We're actually going to talk about it again next week, or I already taught about it again next week. But the idea of needs versus wants. And a lot of times something is a need because we really want it. But God knows what we actually need. And God has power over every need you have. There isn't something where God's like, you know what, good luck, you're on your own. Or, you know, figure that out. He cares about every need you have. And in Luke chapter 9, this passage is recorded. And again, you're probably familiar with this story if you've never gone to church. In Luke chapter 9, verse 13, it says, late in the afternoon, Jesus was preaching at the top of this mountain to all these people, masses of people, and we find out later, 5,000 men, probably women, children, so we're looking at 15,000, 20,000 people. Late in the afternoon, the 12, meaning the disciples, came to Jesus and said, send the crowd away so that they can go to the surrounding villages and countryside and find food and lodging. Because we're in a remote place here. Like, it's getting late in the day. It's dinner time. Send them away so they can get some food because there ain't nothing here. Let them go get dinner. Stop by Starbucks. Grab some coffee on the way. McDonald's. Go through the drive-thru at Chick-fil-A. And come back, and then we can continue. But Jesus replied, you give them something to eat. Okay, thanks, Jesus. That's helpful. Appreciate that. Yeah, the 20,000, the 15,000 people. Oh, sure, it's right here in my pocket. They answered, we only have 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, unless we go and buy food for all this crowd. And obviously they don't have the time for that. I mean, even good Chick-fil-A catering couldn't be that quick. And again, about 5,000 men were there. So it goes on and says, but he said, Jesus said to his disciples, next slide, have them sit down in groups of about 50 each. The disciples did so, and everyone sat down. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke them. Then he gave them to the disciples to distribute to the people. 5 loaves, two fish. 15 to 20,000 people. It says that they all ate and were satisfied. That's important. It's not like, well, I got a little nibble, huh? Okay, we'll call that a feeding. No, they ate and were full. They had all they needed. They had all that they were out in the middle of nowhere, had nothing, but they ate and were satisfied. They weren't going, oh, I wish I had more. Can I get something else here? Can I get seconds? Is there second helpings allowed? They were satisfied. They all ate. We're satisfied. And that could have been the end of the miracle, and we would have been like, whoa, God, that's incredible. You just fed 15 to 20,000 people with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Wow. But then it says, and the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. This didn't need to happen. It wouldn't have changed the miracle. But that's the extent of God's power. Saying, look, I not only provide what you need, but I can provide abundantly, above and beyond what you need. As Paul says, beyond what we can ever ask or imagine. And so, again, the miracle could have ended right after satisfied. But they picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. Because God was just showing, Jesus was showing his disciples and these people, these 20,000, 15,000 people, that I've got your every need. I've got it in my hands. Every need you have, I have control over it. And even when you think like, oh, is that going to be enough? Like, oh, I can give above and beyond. I've got every need in your hands. And it's not just the big things. But the little things too. And we've talked about this before. And again, I don't know if I talked about it last week or if I'm talking about it next week. But James says that every good and perfect gift is from above, from our Father, our generous God who loves to give. And that's the God we serve. Like, whatever need you have, God's not like, I don't care about that. Sorry, that's too little. Don't bother me. Who do you think you are? That's like, no, I care about every need, no matter how big or small. I care about every need you have because God is in the details. Then the third thing is that God's power can handle every difficulty you endure. Every difficulty, every hard thing that you go through, God can handle it. God has the power for it. And in this passage that I think Kendra mentioned in her prayer, in Mark chapter 4, you're probably familiar with this one as well. It says, a furious squall came up. The disciples were out in a boat in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. A furious squall, a huge storm came up, and the waves broke over the boat, so it was nearly swamped. It's going down. And again, we referred to this before. Jesus is in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. Like, just to add the detail there. He's asleep on a cushion at the front of this little fishing boat. So it's not like he didn't know what was going on. He's not, like, underneath in the extra cabin of this yacht. Like, he's right there. He's getting, swamped as well. And the disciples woke him and said, teacher, don't you care if we drown? So he got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, quiet, be still. Like, it kind of be like, I don't know if he's asleep. Like, what? Okay, quiet, be still. All right. Like that's kind of how, like, it was that instantly. The wind died down. It was completely calm. And then he said to his disciples, why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? Like, you're in a big, difficult situation, and Jesus is right there with you. And maybe this is a metaphor. I mean, the story actually happened, but I meant for us. That every difficult situation, Jesus is right there with us. Why are we afraid? God's got every situation, every difficulty. And then this is what happens. It says they were terrified and asked each other, who is this? Because up until now, they'd seen him like heal a guy's hand and turn water into wine and some little miracling, you know, kind of an everyday Miracle Max kind of thing. But now this was incredible. Now we're talking about nature. We're talking about a storm. And they said, who is this that even the wind and waves obey him? And that's true for us too, that in our situations, our difficulties, God has the power even for that. Even if, and we'll get this in a moment, and I know we're running out of moments, but even the mistakes that are caused by your own stupidness, even those difficulties, God has the power to handle. And I know you're not stupid. Yeah, you are. So am I. But every difficulty you endure, now I just want to be clear, I mean, he has control over every difficulty in your life. He can fix, resolve anything. But that doesn't mean he will. Because as we've said so many times, God uses the challenges in our lives for our growth. And so sometimes God might be bringing you through something difficult on purpose because he has something bigger in mind. And we talked about that last week. You're looking at your own little piece of the puzzle and God's like, oh, out here, like eight pieces over, I've got something big going on and you need to go through this now because of that. But he has the power to handle every detail of your life, even that, even the little things, even the wind and the waves. Obey him. And then finally, even that God's power can handle every sin you commit. There is nothing that you have done that is the God's like, nope, sorry, that one's crossed the line. I don't deal with that one. Nope, I'm tired of it. You've done it too many times. Oh, that one's really bad. That one makes people really angry. You've been doing this, nobody even knows about it. Like, whatever. There is nothing that God's like, no, I can't handle that. His power can handle every sin you commit. And I'm going to paraphrase this story here. But in Luke chapter 7, there's a story of Jesus is at the house of the Pharisees. And this woman, it says she was a sinful woman, immoral woman, it says, came in. She brought a jar full of perfume. And she knelt behind Jesus at his feet, weeping at her own sin, at her own brokenness in the presence of Jesus. And so her tears were there. She wiped her tears off with her hair. Wiped his feet off. Sorry. Her tears fell on his feet. I should just read it. Her tears fell on his feet. She used her hair to wipe it off. And she kept kissing his feet and putting perfume on them, which is just a sign of honor and respect. And then this is the interesting part I will read. It says, not that the rest of it wasn't interesting, but it says, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, Pharisee, not a religious leader, not really interested necessarily in Jesus, trying to catch him, says to himself, not out loud, important, if this man were a prophet, he would know what kind of woman is touching him. She's a sinner. Like, this is a bad lady. She's done a lot of bad things. And this man thinks to himself, if Jesus was a prophet, he would know who's touching him. And I love this, because Jesus is awesome. So Jesus answered his thoughts. Simon, he said to him, I have something to say to you. And he responds to this guy's thoughts. You know, if only Jesus was a prophet. Well, actually, Jesus is a prophet, and he can respond to this guy's thoughts. Just kind of fun. He says, you know, basically, a guy loaned money to two people, 500 to one, 50 to the other. Neither of them repay, so he forgave both debts, canceling it. Who do you suppose loved him more after that? Jesus is asking the man, this Pharisee. And Simon answered, next slide there, I suppose the one for whom he canceled the larger debt. He said, that's right. So the point is, if you owe someone $500 and someone else owes $50 and the person you owe says, no, I'm going to cancel both debts, $500 person is going like, wow, I get it. Thank you so much. And he said, that's right. So he turned to the woman and said to Simon, look at this woman kneeling here. And he goes on and says, I entered your home. You didn't wash my feet. You didn't do anything for me. But this woman did all that and then actually gave me perfume and was wiping her hair, wiping my feet with her hair, like saying she has honored me in a way that you didn't at all. And so he goes on and says, I tell you, next slide there, her sins, and they are many. Jesus acknowledges this. She's done a lot of stuff. She's messed up a lot. But they have been forgiven. So she's shown me love. It's much love. But a person who's forgiven little only shows a little love. Jesus said to the woman, your sins are forgiven. And they're like, who is this guy that can forgive sins? And so your story is the same. And maybe it's not. Maybe you're pretty good. I don't know. But I know I look at myself and I'm like, man, I'm that person. I'm that person who has sins and they are many. And Jesus says, I've forgiven all of them. That's what the cross was all about. Every sin. There's nothing that you committed that God wouldn't, that can't forgive. And people are like, what about the unpardonable sin? You can't, if you're worried, let's just leave it at this. I can talk about theology with it if you want. But if you're worried about committing the unpardonable sin, you aren't committing the unpardonable sin. Let's just leave it at that. If you want to talk more, I can give you more reasons why. You don't need to worry about that because every sin that you commit or have committed or will commit has been forgiven by Jesus on the cross. Every one of them. Just like this woman. And she recognized how much she had been forgiven. And maybe we need to recognize, no, we've been forgiven too. We have been forgiven our sins, every sin we've committed. So those are God's power can handle every detail of your future, every need you have, every detail, difficulty you endure, and every sin you commit. And the point is that our sense of smell can underestimate the extent of God's power. Let's not get caught up in, oh, what I can experience. No, God's power is so great that they didn't smell like smoke. God's power is so great that the ground was dry. God's power is so great that there were 12 basketfuls left over. God's power is so great that even the wind and waves obey. God's power is so great that even a sinful woman has been completely forgiven. That's God's power. So don't underestimate the extent of God's power. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for your power and that we can look at this story of the image of gold and realize that your power is so much greater than all that, but your power even matters in the details. That you have power over the little things in our lives too, and we are grateful. And I pray that you would help us to reflect and remember that as we live our lives, that there is nothing that you can't handle. There is no sin that you can't forgive. There is no step in our future that you don't already have the details planned. God, there is no need that we have that you cannot come, that you will not be able to come through on. Help us to trust you and to, as we saw last week, live by faith, not by smell. Thank you for all that you have done for us. In Jesus' name, amen.